I want to see science serve a useful purpose to improve the standard of living for all people.
Hey, why is anyone fighting food advance? A very small percentage of the world's population is fortunate enough to have the luxury of turning down food.
We've arranged a society based on science and technology in which nobody understands anything about science and technology.
You can't build a peaceful world on empty stomachs and human misery.
You're listening to Talking Biotech, a weekly podcast illuminating issues in agricultural and medical biotechnology. Your questions and concerns are addressed using a science-based approach with the goal of driving discovery to application with communication. Now here's your host, Dr. Kevin Folta.
And welcome again to the Talking Biotech podcast. We're the weekly podcast where we discuss new innovations in both medicine and agriculture, especially as they relate to biotechnology, coming up with new innovations that can help people and help the planet. I'm Kevin Folta, and today we have a unique opportunity to talk to somebody who was there from the very beginning. We go to Saskatoon, Canada, to Dr. Maurice Maloney, the Executive Director and CEO of the Global Institute for Food Security. Thank you for joining us today, Dr. Maloney.
Thank you very much for the invitation, Kevin.
Yeah, this is really great. I'm so excited that we have an opportunity to do this. It's been on the schedule for a very long time. So could you tell us a little bit about your background and your roots from kind of the beginning of many of the aspects of what we think of as modern biotechnology?
Yeah, well, I fell into the biotechnology revolution, Kevin, in a rather serendipitous way. I was a postdoc in Switzerland at the time, expecting to go back to the UK for a faculty position. And at that time, I would have been classified as a plant biochemist or a plant physiologist. Things weren't going so well in Britain at the time. Mrs. Thatcher was closing down university departments. And so I actually became part of what was known as the brain drain of folks that moved across the Atlantic to work in the United States. And instead of going to a university, I was invited to visit Calgene in Davis, California, which was one of the first plant biotechnology companies that had been set up. So this is in the early 80s. And I was so enamored by the ambition of this company and the vision they had. I said, that's what I want to do. And so instead of moving to a university and becoming, you know, a more conventional academic, I ended up moving straight into the industry. Having said that, you know, the company itself was doing such groundbreaking research that it was research worthy of any cutting edge laboratory in the world.
And so you said this was about early 1980s or so that you were there?
Yeah, 1982.
And so what were some of the hot ideas at the time that people were thinking about? And this, just for context, this is about when plant transformation and regeneration is being demonstrated in other laboratories. So where was Calgene and what were you up to and what were some of the breakthroughs at that time?
Right. So the vision was phenomenal. So the vision was, improve photosynthesis in plants. Let's figure out a way of making plants much more economical about the way they use nutrients like nitrogen and potassium and so on. So things that are still on the menu right now. But also, let's make plants much more resilient, maybe against diseases and so on, against insect pests and the like. So the vision was there. The big problem was at that point, when I moved to Calgene, nobody had actually introduced a gene into plants and demonstrated that they could make that gene function. So we were in basically a global competition, which involved some academic labs, the University of Ghent in Belgium, University of Washington in Seattle, and companies like Monsanto, all of whom were focusing on ways in which we might be able to mobilize genes and put them into plants. And Calgene was part of that mix. Calgene never did any work on what you might call model systems. It moved straight into crops. And as a result, it actually wasn't the first group to make a transgenic plant, but we were amongst the first to make transgenic crops.
And what was the first transgenic crop to come out of Calgene? Well, be experimented with at Calgene.
Yeah, so the two that we did very early on in this cycle were transgenic canola, which was in my group, and also transgenic tomatoes. And everybody, I think, now in the history of biotech knows about the Flavor Saver tomato. That was actually the first product that was approved by the FDA that went through the transgenic regulatory approval cycle. We worked in my group on brassica species, of which canola is the most important, because what we were interested in doing is modifying the biochemistry of the oils, because plant lipids are really a very important part of the human diet, and there's lots of ways in which we knew we could improve those oils. So it was critical for us to find a mechanism by which we could mobilize these genes into canola, because then that would open up the whole question of improving the quality of the oils that were associated with that oilseed.
Well, that's really interesting because, well, actually, it's kind of funny. The first plant I transformed was canola too, and that was in maybe 1988 when I was working at Cargill, of all places. But I was only working there as an intern, and it's where I learned I didn't want to work in a company. But at the time, I didn't even know what canola was, but learned about it, and this is late 80s, as having a very favorable oil profile, lots of monounsaturated fats. So what would be an alternative to that inside the oil composition?
Yes. Yeah, so the first thing we were interested in is looking at the chain length of the oils, because canola has been selected to have shorter chain length oils, C18 oils basically, which are very much olive oil like in their general properties. But also then there was a lot of evidence for the benefits of polyunsaturated fatty acids. And that would be things like linoleic acid particularly. While reducing very heavily unsaturated fatty acids like linolenic acid, because linolenic acid oxidizes and can actually give a kind of fishy smell to vegetable oils. So you could improve shelf life and the health qualities of some of these oils in that way.
And a lot of our listenership may not be familiar with what exactly canola is. And could you give us just a few words on what it is and why it's important?
Yes. So canola is the major oil seed in the brassica family. So it's connected very directly to the cabbage family and so on. We tend to think of brassicas as being vegetable crops or possibly root crops like rutabagas and so on. But in fact, brassicas also provide a very large bulk of vegetable oil for the world. Brassica oils are particularly important in Canada, where we have almost 10 million hectares now. But they're also very important in India and China. Again, major source of good vegetable oil in China is still brassicas. So canola is a brassica oil seed. It's a particularly useful one because it's got very high percentage of oil in the seed. we tend to think of soybean as being an oil seed, but actually soybean only has about 17% oil. And soybean is really a protein seed that has oil in it, whereas these brassica crops are true oil seeds with 40 to 44% by weight oil.
And were you doing any work with the glyphosate tolerance, or was that a different company's vision at the time?
No, it was exactly aligned, because while we were working on the development of the gene transfer systems for canola, Luca Comai and Dave Stalker, brilliant scientists in Calgene, were working on herbicide resistance strategies. And they came up with what was referred to as the ROA gene. It was a bacterial gene that enabled us, when we put it into plants, to get quite high levels of tolerance to glyphosate, which we quite liked, because of all the various herbicides on the market at the time, glyphosate is, from a toxicological point of view, by far and away the most benign herbicide that's ever been invented. You know, in terms of its risk, it is about four times less toxic than common salt. So you could eat glyphosate and basically break it down into innocuous components. So we really liked that as a herbicide, but it is a herbicide that was capable of arresting the growth of pretty much any green plant. And so what we needed to do is make the crop plant resistant. And that's through collaboration with Luca and Dave, Luca Comai and Dave Stalker, we were able to make the first herbicide-resistant canola plants.
Yeah, ironically, that now in California, glyphosate is being potentially labeled as a carcinogen. I don't know if you've heard that story.
Yeah, and that has actually come out of a what can only be described as a meta-analysis that was done by one of the United Nations organizations. I think most serious toxicologists do not give it an awful lot of credence, simply because it's not really based on any good experimental evidence. The amount of toxicology work that's been done on the active ingredient in glyphosate, which is phosphonylmethylglycine, suggests that it is extremely benign and is broken down in the soil rapidly. And the major byproducts are glycine, an amino acid, and phosphate.
Yeah, pretty benign stuff. It's I'm familiar with that discussion, and it's really disappointing. And luckily, we'll have somebody on the podcast in a few weeks who's going to really dig into the IARC decision and the literature that is supporting or not supporting of it. So we'll have a good distillation of that in just a few weeks. But what about other crops? What about, and I know that in your background, you've worked on a variety of different projects and in a huge variety of different plants, or well, at least a series of different plants with a variety of different products. What were some of the things that you've worked on, and maybe the rationale for them, and where are they now?
Yeah, so we continued from the work that I did in Calgene. We certainly developed a strong interest in looking at the metabolism of oil seeds to see if you could actually make even more interesting, healthier oils. And we did work subsequently on gamma linolenic acid. Now, that took a little bit more metabolic engineering in order to persuade a canola plant to make gamma linolenic acid. And when you you do that, you produce something that's rather like an evening primrose oil. Very very valuable oil. Is used as a nutrient, a nutritional supplement primarily. But it's strong evidence that it does actually boost the immune system. Oddly enough, in companion animals like dogs, it's an essential ingredient in improving the quality of their fur and their coats. So it's got used is both in humans and in pets. We also have focused our attention on something that's got both major nutritional value but major ecological value, and that is finding substitutes for fish oils. Now, I think these days everybody knows that fish oils are good for you. Not everybody knows quite why they are, but fish accumulate long-chain fatty acids. And those long-chain fatty acids are actually the major fatty acids found in brain. So they are an essential component of the mammalian brain, the human brain. And they have to be absorbed primarily through nutrition. We don't make enough in the human body to supply it all. Hence the importance of finding natural sources of these oils. The problem with fish oils is, of course, we have overfished the stocks of wild fish. And the sad truth is that although they're called fish oils, it's not the fish that made them. Fish eat them in the form of eating krill and the krill eating algae. There's a whole food chain there, but essentially these oils start out life in algae and end up in fish. That means if you run out of wild fish and you move to fish farming, although you can produce a perfectly viable looking fish, it doesn't have as much of these beneficial oils, unless you've got some way of supplementing it. So we said, well, if it's an alga that makes the oils, then surely we should be able to mobilize the genes from algae into crop plants, because algae are plants. They just happen to be plants that live in the sea. But we should be able to mobilize those genes and get crop plants to make these highly valuable fish oils. If we can do it, then it takes an awful lot of pressure off fishing for wild fish to get these fish oils. And it would enable us eventually to introduce a vegetable-based fish oil into the diet of farmed fish, and therefore the fish farmed fish would have exactly the same nutrient properties as wild fish. And it will take an awful lot of pressure off overfishing. So anyway, that's now being done, and there's a few labs in the world that have succeeded in producing levels of these fish oils that are commercially viable. The CSIRO, where I used to work in Australia, has done this, and also Rothamsted Research, where I was the director, have also demonstrated you can make commercially viable levels of these fish oils in plants. So we see this as a victory not only for nutrition, but actually for the whole of the oceanic ecology, because we're going to disturb much less the food chains.
Are any of those fish oil fish oils that you're supplementing with fish, can they be consumed directly by humans and get the same benefit?
Yes, they can, and they're actually on the markets already in capsule form, being made in yeast, in fermentation tanks. Now, that is too expensive to use as you might call a general nutritional supplement, that you might add to other food products like yogurts that kids eat and so on. But it certainly, from a proof of concept point of view, it already exists, and it is possible to get these alternative sources of these oils. The main thing is to get them at a price now that is reasonable, that can be a proper substitute for fish oils.
Well, that's really good so far. Let's take a break here, and then when we come back on the other side, I'd like to just kind of have a conversation with you about your vision of where we're going. I know that, you know, you've been around a lot, so you've worked at all the wonderful places on this planet, it seems. Let's follow up then on the other side of the break at the Talking Biotech Podcast.
Greetings, Talking Biotech aficionados, and thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech podcast. Thanks to you. You've written great, wonderful reviews on iTunes, and it's quite a beacon to the podcast surfer. Shows your amazing support for this mofo of a science show. And special thanks to you who dared to accept my challenge and got that Talking Biotech tattoo. It's appreciated, but guess what? That tattoo lasts a really long time. It's my hope that someday, a few decades from now, we can look at your dermal commitment to a science podcast and ridicule you for defacing your flesh. Our hope is that your days in assisted living will use that tat as a conversation starter, reminding the elderly of the dark ages when science was shunned for flashy marketing and myth that placed fear over reason. However, with the support of so many listeners, we're moving innovation to application and helping people and planet along the way. So tell a friend, write a review on iTunes, and most of all, share the beautiful science that we learn from the expert guests that kindly share their expertise here on the Talking Biotech podcast.
And so we're back at the Talking Biotech podcast today with Dr. Maurice Maloney, Executive Director and CEO of Global Institute for Technology in Saskatoon, Canada. And we're talking about biotechnology from the past and the future, and skipping the present because it's not very much fun. A lot of Roundup Ready crops in BT. So Dr. Maloney has been around for a long time in different companies and is different academic and other government institutions, and has seen a lot of what has happened in the past. So looking forward, I guess, you know, what are some of your thoughts about the backlog that we currently are seeing in terms of good technology that's kind of stuck in limbo because of regulatory or other issues?
Yeah, it's a great point, Kevin, because although I would still say the biotech revolution for farming has been amazingly productive, it's actually been amazingly productive with relatively few traits. One of the traits that we haven't seen an awful lot of activity in is actually disease resistance. So we do have some pest resistance, things like BT for insect pests, but disease resistance, there's phenomenal opportunities. And while there has been a lot of pushback about biotech crops around the world, scientists have continued to move the basic discovery science forward so that now we do have some interesting opportunities. I'll give you one because it's very close to my heart, Kevin, because I'm Irish. And if there was ever an example of the effects of food insecurity in the modern world, it's the Irish potato famine. And the Irish potato famine resulted in more than 1 million deaths in a period of about 4 or 5 years in Ireland, and also resulted in more than 1 million exported people from Ireland, most of whom went to the United Kingdom, to the United States. And the dynamic of population change just because of a plant disease is still vivid in the memory of Ireland. Now, the disease that caused that, late blight, is caused by a pathogen called Phytophthora infestans. And you would have thought in the intervening 150 years we would have solved that problem. But in conventional breeding, we have never been able to solve that problem. However, biotechnologists have taken hold of this, and I refer particularly to work from Jonathan Jones's lab in the Sainsbury lab in the UK, where they have looked at wild potato relatives that show high levels of resistance to late blight. And the question was, could you actually cross these wild potato relatives with a modern potato that we use for French fries and baked potatoes, and make sure you get those resistance genes in, basically by conventional breeding? The answer is yes, you could do it, but it would take about 25 years for the reversion of the germplasm to settle down to become something very similar to our current commercial varieties. So how do you do it? Well, you do it by using genomics and using biotechnology. The genes for that resistance have been identified, and they've been mobilized in a single generation into modern potato cultivars, the ones that we use for making French fries and mashed potatoes. And lo and behold, within 2 years of field trials, Jonathan Jones and his team were able to demonstrate high levels of tolerance to this pathogen that's been plaguing us now for well over 150 years. So at the moment, if you tried to get that through the regulatory system in Europe, it would still be very difficult. But it's a wonderful example of what biotechnology can do, because even when it's possible to do something by conventional breeding, the time involved is so long that you may as well just go to the end result by a more rapid route. And the more rapid route here is what we would now call a biotechnology crop or a transgenic crop. So there are fantastic examples like that that have become available. I think disease resistance is going to be a major trait that we begin to introduce into important staples. There's another thing below ground that we also have technology to address, but has never been incorporated into commercial crops yet, and that's nematode resistance. Nematodes in some parts of the world can actually account for 40% losses in our crops. Well, you know, if we could make roots resistant to some of these pests that we never even see because they're microscopic and below ground, it will make an absolutely dramatic difference. And not only to modern high production agriculture, but actually will solve food security problems for impoverished people around the world.
Yeah, and I think when you going back to the late blight and the potato, the idea that even you could breed it in 25 years, I mean, I think that's really generous. Dealing with cultivated potatoes are tetraploid, and so I think the idea of being able to take a potato gene and move it from one potato to a different potato, it seems like such a no-brainer to me. And when you talk to folks in the potato industry or other industries, let's just say, you know, in citrus or strawberry, whatever, you can say we can solve your disease problems with a transgene by bringing in a gene maybe from the same species, but just turning it on all the time. But, you know, insecticides or fungicides are cheap, nematicides are cheap, and they work. And so it costs a lot less to use these compounds that we'd rather not use, that we'd rather not introduce to the environment. It costs less to do that than to go through the regulatory hurdles of deregulation. So so what's wrong with using this improved technology?
Yeah, because the foundation of the whole of biotechnology in crops that we talked about earlier in the earlier segment, Kevin, was basically, let's see if we can produce crops that protect themselves rather than having to use chemicals. Because we all knew that no matter how good the agricultural chemicals are, first of all, there'll always be suspicion about residues and stuff like this. But secondly, the pathogens and pests mutate and become resistant to them eventually. And so we were always interested from the very beginning in introducing biological means into the plant by which it can protect itself. And then we're free from using chemicals that eventually will become obsolete due to resistance problems. So I think that's the direction all of agriculture is going to go. It reduces the input costs for farmers enormously. It actually reduces the risk to farmers because, particularly insecticides, probably the group that farmers like the least when they have to spray. If you can substitute those, as we have done with BT, there's an enormous reduction in the use of those chemicals and an actual improvement in the overall farm ecology because you're not hitting non-target pests.
Exactly. No, it's a really good distillation. Now, you talked about, you know, maybe your favorite one with the potato, with the Phytophthora infestans resistance. But what other traits are you aware of in the pipeline that maybe are maybe the most interesting, maybe that cover a niche of humanity or a niche problem? What do you think there?
Well, you know, I mean, one of the ticking time bombs is everybody's favorite fruit, and that is bananas. You know, bananas are popular throughout the developed and the developing world, and probably most consumers of bananas are not cognizant of the fact that bananas basically do not represent a great diversity of germplasm, so a great diversity of genetics, essentially. Now, that's a problem when a disease crops up. And if you have a particular disease and you've got a relatively narrow genetic base for your crop, it could wipe out the whole crop. And so with bananas, which are propagated not by seed normally, but actually done vegetatively by cuttings, which is the way we propagate a lot of our houseplants, bananas are at high risk. The only way to solve that problem in any kind of timely manner will be to mobilize disease resistance genes that are isolated from close relatives to bananas. And if we want to do that in a timely manner, that's the approach we're going to have to take. Otherwise, we're going to see, in 1 year, when it could be next year, it could be the year after, just a massive reduction in yields because of fungal and actually viral diseases.
Yeah, and that's the important part there is that, you know, you and I can talk about, you know, no banana for our banana split, you know, and, you know, woe is me. But there's a huge number of people on the planet where the banana is the central carbohydrate in their diet and a daily staple.
You bet. I mean, you tell people of Uganda you won't have any bananas this year, that translates to them as being a starvation situation.
Yeah, and for people who would like to know more about the banana situation, check out episode 29 of the podcast series. We had a discussion with Lena Tripathi, and she's at ITRA in over in Kenya, Nairobi, Kenya, and actually gave a really nice discussion of the different banana diseases and some of their potential biotech cures. And so that's one that we have in the bank. You and I had discussed some of the ways in which biotechnology could help mediate the effects of climate change. And what are some of the ideas in the pipeline there that you're aware of?
Also a great point, because agriculture, unfortunately, is often portrayed in the climate change debate as a problem, when in fact it is one of our major opportunities for solutions. It's not just a question of making crops that are resilient to climate change, but actually photosynthesis, the main thing that crops do, absorbs massive amounts of CO2 around the world. And as a result, plants can be a net sink for the very gas that we want to reduce in the atmosphere. Now, there are some really interesting approaches to this, and some of those approaches are almost invisible to us because they happen below ground. Work that's gone on both with rangeland breeders looking for deep-rooting grasses and also in crops like wheat. People like Michelle Watt, formerly from CSIRO in Australia, looking for drought resistance in wheat. Turns out the best cases are ones that are very deep-rooting, high-rooting biomass. But when a plant does that, when it produces a lot of roots, not only does it protect itself against drought, but it's actually sequestering large amounts of carbon. And it's been calculated by Douglas Kell, former chief executive of the Biotechnology and Biological Sciences Research Council in the UK, that about 160 million hectares of deep-rooting grasses would actually absorb all of the industrial carbon produced on Earth. So, in other words, the maths aren't completely out of whack by an order of magnitude. It is actually feasible that plants selected for this high biomass accumulation, particularly below ground, could actually be part of our solution to reducing CO2 in the atmosphere.
Yeah, that's really, it opens up another discussion too, that when you have plants that can sequester large amounts of carbon, in whether it's going to be biomass or, you know, cellulosic accumulation, or whether we're talking about, say, oil, it opens up so many opportunities for renewable fuels. And I've been really, I saw a thing last week about biodiesel and was just blown away by how much they can produce while making soybean meal for animals to eat. The oil is basically a byproduct, and we really could be doing a lot more to generate renewable fuels based upon plants as that intermediate.
Absolutely. The reason why we haven't done it, of course, is there is always a bit of a competition for land space between food and non-food plants. But of course, the other issue which we've got to grips with more recently now is this whole question of photosynthetic efficiency. And there's been such breakthroughs in the last 2 or 3 years by major labs in the world working on photosynthetic efficiency, that it's now conceivable to grow a lot of the, what you might call, biomass crops for biofuels on more marginal land. And if they did have the improved photosynthetic efficiency, which seems to be promised by this next generation of technology coming out of the University of Illinois, Oxford University, Cambridge, and so on, we would be in a position to devote a substantial amount of non-agricultural land to producing biofuels, and therefore not only sequestering carbon and making a virtuous cycle out of this, but of course reducing the amount of fossil fuels that we use.
And along that line, if there was a, you know, if I gave you the secret powers to change, or let's just say approve, one product that you either know in the pipeline or something you could dream up, what do you think the most important place we could use that transgenic approach might be today?
I think basically opening the gates on disease resistance as the next generation of biotechnology products would be a very important step forward. There are quite a few that are in the stables of companies and, in fact, university and institute laboratories. If some of those could get through a regulatory cycle that was not prohibitive, but was actually enabling these things to get to market fairly rapidly, then we would see a great shift in the way we do our agriculture, because we would almost be getting to the point between insect resistance and disease resistance of reducing the chemical dependency that we have for high production crops. I think the consumer would be ecstatic about seeing those things come to reality.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's a great place to start. And would you be willing to venture a prediction on what will happen with regulation of gene editing, like CRISPR-Cas9, Talens, that kind of thing?
Well, of course, I'd be very encouraged to see both how the North American agencies, USDA, and the CFIA in Canada have handled these things. And as a result, they are not really treated any differently from conventional mutagenesis breeding, which is basically a standard part of all plant breeding these days. Even if you grow organic crops, you're still using germplasm that underwent mutagenesis breeding. In Europe, it's still going to be a bit of a knife edge. But I do believe that there's a whole generation of anti-biotech people in the European Commission that are basically reaching retirement age. There's a lot more young people that have entered into the regulatory scene in the European Commission who are looking at these things from a very different point of view. And they recognize the environmental benefits as well as the crop productivity benefits. And with something as easy to do as genome editing, where you could get some quick wins with very little expenditure in terms of further research, I think I'm more hopeful than I've ever been. But really, it does require that turnover, just like it does in the scientific world. Every 25 years, a lot of people retire, and surprise, surprise, some of the hypotheses that were not so popular become more prevalent canonical pieces of science. I think that's going to happen in Europe with respect to genomics and biotechnology, and it will probably be through the simplicity of genome editing.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that one of the other drivers that we is kind of a wild card is going to be the tremendous investment that's being made in places like China, the ambitions of folks on the continent in Africa, that there are so many pockets of innovation that where governments have said, we want this and we're going to make it happen. And I think that's no one's going to wait for us anymore. And I think that that may be a very important impetus as we try to feed 10 billion people by 2050. Well, one of the central problems that we consistently hear of is how do we deal with food security issues as we have increasing populations, less water, limited space? How can biotechnology really help feed those 10 billion people by 2050?
Yeah, this is really important, Kevin, because whether we like it or not, we're heading for a crisis and we will have to address it. Now, everybody worries about climate change, which is a perfectly reasonable thing to worry about. But actually, the population dynamics between now and 2050 are formidable. And they're formidable in two ways. We do have a very large purchasing power coming out of increasing populations in Asia that are going to demand high quality food from our farming systems between now and 2050. And there's also a disenfranchised roughly 1 billion people around the world that still live a subsistence lifestyle. So they're lucky to have enough calories per day to keep them alive. Two different realities, and we've got to address both realities if we're going to avert crises and disasters between now and it peaking out at roughly 9.6 to 10 billion people in 2050. When you think how close 2050 is, we actually don't have the luxury of using what you might call conventional technology, which is quite slow. It gets there eventually, but it won't get there fast enough to feed all of these people. So we are going to have a step change in the rate at which we find ways of increasing our crop yields and our nutritional quality. And if we don't do that, we will have international crises that we'll all regret and we'll all wish that we had mobilized the knowledge that we currently have to solve those problems.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Maloney. It was a really, really great discussion. I'm really glad that you were able to join us and really impart from your experience in the past and share some of your visions for the future. If people want to learn more about you or your organization, where would they look online?
So we've got a website, which is gifs.ca. The .ca is Canada, and the GIFS is the Global Institute for Food Security. So that's probably the easiest way of tracking us down. And then we've got all our technology, our personalities, and all our contact numbers and how to communicate with us there.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining me. Stay warm in Saskatoon, and hopefully we'll see you pretty soon.
Thanks a lot, Kevin, and really great to talk with you.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech podcast. Please send your suggestions for guests, comments, or questions to talkingbiotech@gmail.com. Please write a review on iTunes and recommend this podcast to a friend. More downloads and reviews raise the visibility of this podcast and help us reach a wider audience with science.